Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, good to see you.
Yeah.
This long distance podding is kind of wearing on me a little bit though.
Yeah. No, it's living your entire life through Zoom is kind of wearing on me a little bit, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, no more Zoom calls. They've really lost their charm in about like a month.
I know. It's like, it was really cool for like the first few weeks and you're like Zoom happy hours with your friends and stuff. And now you're like,
yeah,
why am I talking to a bunch of disembodied heads and boxes on a screen?
Yeah. I know. It makes me miss the phone. But we digress with our complaints. So we got a big show today. We're going to start with all the latest news out of North Korea. Is Kim Jong-un dead? What do we actually know? What's a rumor? What happens next? So we'll spend some time with that. And then there's a bunch of Iran news this week. They have launched what they called a military satellite into space. They are also getting threatened by Mike Pompeo with more sanctions. So we'll explain all of that. There's some potential legal trouble for President Bolsonaro in Brazil, which would be bad news for Mr. Trump. It's one of his favorite dictators on the planet. And then we have some good news about efforts to eradicate the coronavirus and much, much more. And then, Ben, you did our interview today. Can you talk us through what we're going to hear?
Yeah, you know, we've talked about Modi in India on this show, and there's nobody better to talk to us about that than Rana Ayoob, who's a writer for the Washington Post Global Opinions, but also, you know, a pretty fearless independent journalist who's been kind of exposing the authoritarian nature of Modi and the Hindu nationalist movement in India for a long time now. And some of our listeners may remember she was profiled in a really amazing Dexter Filkins New Yorker piece about India. So we talked to her about COVID-19 in a country where so many people are just struggling to get by and where social distancing is much of an option, as well as what Modi might be doing to take advantage of the crisis through his own politics.
Yeah, she is fearless and an incredible advocate. Yeah. So do not skip that interview. And one quick thing before we get to the news. So we announced a new show this week that we're working on with an incredible journalist named Patrick Radden Keefe in partnership with Pineapple Street Studios and Spotify. It's called Wind of Change. And the question that it will explore is one of the most famous songs of all time that was the anthem for the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, was that written by the CIA? And Patrick will take you on this journey that talks through this mystery, that talks about the long history of the U.S. government and the CIA meddling in foreign cultures and promoting artists and books and activists and films. It is one of the most gripping stories I've ever heard. I have thought about the story nonstop since Patrick first pitched it to us. I could not be more excited for people to check it out. So search for Wind of Change on Spotify. You're going to be able to binge it there, and then it'll start coming out on May 11th. So don't miss that. Ben, you in particular are going to love this one.
Yeah, this is like my ideal content. maybe we could have a sequel on Right Here, Right Now, the Jesus Jones classic that I also associate with the end of the Cold War. But I'm really, really excited about this.
All right. Me too. Well, season two is ready to go then. Okay. Let's go to North Korea. So, Ben, the noise around like this Kim Jong-un situation, it's getting louder. It's really getting more confusing. So do a bit of a roundup of reports and rumors, then see if we can like fact check it as best we can. So first, reports and rumors. So a bunch of outlets said Kim Jong-un had some sort of heart procedure and that it might have gone poorly and that it left him in a vegetative state or like a coma or some sort of serious situation. TMZ, a fan favorite here in Los Angeles, they even got in on the speculation game. They aggregated some foreign media reports and suggested that Kim was dead. So good to see they're getting into foreign policy news. We need more of it.
Yeah.
On Saturday, Reuters reported that China sent a team of doctors and diplomats to North Korea, presumably to help Kim. So that gets us to Monday of this week. Trump gets asked about these reports. He cryptically said he has a very good idea about Kim's condition, but he can't talk about it. But, quote, I just wish him well and that the world would hear more in the not too distant future. Previously, Trump had knocked down a CNN report that the U.S. was monitoring intelligence showing Kim was gravely ill. He called it a fake report, said it was incorrect based on old documents, but like, you know, take his denials for what they're worth. So it does seem to suggest that Kim is still alive unless Trump is wishing a dead guy well, which, you know, happens to the best of us. So we'll find out. On Monday, a South Korean minister said publicly that the South Korean government has enough information to say there's nothing unusual about Kim's health. So it seems like they're knocking it down. North Korea watchers, of which there are many, they spend a lot of time looking at satellite imagery of North Korea, and they track Kim's movements. They notice what they think is Kim Jong-un's personal train at a compound on the East Coast, not in Pyongyang. Kim Jong-un rides around on a personal train. These satellite watchers also say they haven't noticed like unusual military movements or things you might associate with a transition. So, you know, last week you and I talked about how Kim Jong-un skipped his grandfather's birthday celebration on April 15th. That was like the big event that got people talking. Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea, is his grandfather. He's treated like a god. His birthday is Christmas, the 4th of July. It's all rolled into one. So it's a very notable absence. So, you know, Ben, a long windup to say who the hell knows what's happening. But you and I were both at the White House back in 2011 when Kim Jong-il died. He died of a heart attack on a Saturday. North Korea announced it via state news on a Monday. A few hours later, they announced Kim Jong-un was going to be in charge. Maybe the most notable thing at that time was that everyone was caught by surprise, including the Americans, the South Koreans, apparently the entire North Korean Foreign Ministry office. A defector said later that he and his team learned about it on TV. So I wonder if we could start there, Ben. Like, what do you remember from that time in 2011, from both like Kim Jong-il's death and from that leadership transition?
Well, there was like a brief period of uncertainty. You know, he died relatively quickly after this heart attack, Kim Jong-il did. Brief moment of certainty where you saw these indications that something was happening. I think we put out a statement, you know, that was kind of a placeholder that we saw these reports, but we wanted to wait and let the North Koreans announce the death of their leader. And, you know, in part because we didn't want to get it wrong, but, you know, in part because we didn't necessarily want to inject ourselves. And then what happened, right, is that Kim Jong-un becomes the successor. He'd been anointed, but he was kind of totally unknown to us, Tommy. And I remember we had this a ton of meetings trying to speculate about what would happen. And there were some people who thought Kim Jong-un might be more beholden to China because he was a young leader without a lot of experience. You know, there were some people who rightly anticipated that he might kind of go his own way and be a difficult character. But what happened really is, let's face it, none of us, for all the North Korea watchers, you know, predicting what's going to happen inside of a totally closed society like that is difficult. What ended up happening is Kim Jong-un showed his true colors over the course of the next year or so as he started to kill any potential rivals, including the uncle that everybody thought might kind of control him on behalf of China, because this uncle was somewhat close to the Chinese. So again, I think if there's a lesson there, I think it suggests that if there is some kind of succession, it's likely to be bloody. You know, there's likely to be purges in order for whoever emerges to consolidate power. But like you said, we don't know. We seem to know enough to know that there's something wrong with Kim Jong-un, or else he wouldn't have missed these events, and you probably wouldn't see this degree of speculation in even Asian media. But really, until we get some smoke signal here, we just don't know for sure.
The degree of speculation, even among like very senior and serious journalists, is pretty hilarious. Like the AP had a full report on past disappearances by North Korean leaders.
Yeah.
Like I guess in 86, there was a report in South Korean newspapers that Kim Il-sung was dead. And then he showed up like a couple hours later to meet a foreign delegation at the airport. In 2004, there was a big explosion at a train station at like a depot between China and North Korea that was just hours after Kim Jong-il passed through. So there's all these attempts at, like, I guess, Kremlinology. I don't know what we're doing here to, like, try to figure this out. But it's funny to watch.
Yeah, and like, nobody knows. Like, nobody who's predicting on Twitter has any idea. Maybe the U.S. has some intelligence about this. You know, Trump's comments seem to suggest he'd seen something. But that intelligence might not even be definitive. It may just be that Kim Jong-un hasn't been seen for days, that there are people around him, you know, who've shown unusual behavior, or the report that the Chinese may have sent a medical team. So everybody's trying to piece together these shreds of information, but really we don't know.
Wait. Have you been watching the Michael Jordan documentary?
Yeah, of course.
Have you seen the part about how Dennis Rodman went on a bender that was supposed to be 48 hours and then just extended?
Yeah.
What if they're together?
This could just be really an epic bender.
You know? Maybe they're like in Macau somewhere. Joking aside, so like a friend of the pod, Asia expert Danny Russell, who's been on the show a bunch of times and knows more about this than anyone I know, had a great piece in the Los Angeles Times that everyone should check out about like what comes next and then the big challenges. So Danny smartly points out that the succession process in North Korea is very unclear because their political system, as Danny describes it, is a Frankenstein-like mashup of models. It's a religious cult. It's a Sopranos-like crime family. It's a monarchy. It's a Leninist dictatorship. So there's not like a roadmap you can look to about how the process should work. So again, we're speculating. Kim Jong-un's oldest child is, I think, 10 years old, so presumably too young to take over, so it should have to be someone else. People are talking a lot about Kim Jong-un's sister, who has taken more of a public role recently. Kim Jong-un had his brother Kim Jong-nam assassinated back in 2017, as you referenced earlier. I guess there's another brother who was sort of iced out of all leadership positions. And like, you know, Kim Jong-il thought he was kind of a wimp or something. Danny notes, as you just did, that it's been 6 years since Kim executed the uncle that was supposed to ride herd on him, and points out that five of the seven senior officials who walked with Kim Jong-un in his father's funeral procession are dead or disappeared. And of the two who remain, they're in their 90s. Yeah. So again, long wind up to say, who knows? But like, here's what we do know and what I want to ask you. So one, Trump invested a ton of time personally into one person, Kim Jong-un. And like so far, that has bought North Korea a lot of time to develop nukes and missiles and has gotten us nothing. It also means that like lower level diplomats are often ignored or iced out because there's this senior level communication that they prefer. Two, North Korea has dozens of nuclear weapons. And, you know, those things getting sold or falling to the wrong hands are the gravest threats maybe to our national security, period. Well, you know, second to a pandemic, actually. But so, Ben, I want to ask you about that nuclear piece for a second. Like, what kind of contingency planning do you think is happening at the Pentagon right now or in Beijing for what to do if this government falls, if those nukes go into the wrong hands, like if things break bad?
It's a good question, because I think there's different scenarios, right? There's a scenario where the sister emerges. There's a scenario where, you know, we said last week it's kind of a misogynist patriarchal society, so maybe a general emerges instead of the sister. Maybe somebody puts himself forward as kind of a regent for this 10-year-old kid. I mean, but there is a scenario where it kind of collapses like a house of cards, you know. I don't think that's the most likely scenario because the elite in that country are pretty invested in the current power structure. But I think the nightmare scenario, as horrible as, you know, this kind of dictatorship obviously is, and as much as you'd like to see that change, if the place just collapses and you have all these nuclear weapons, that is the type of scenario that was sometimes discussed in the Situation Room as a contingency that we had to be worried about. And frankly, it's a contingency that we should probably talk to China about. And when it comes to the nuclear weapons, I frankly don't think the United States even knows where all those nuclear weapons are. You know, I don't think we have a clear sense of the entirety of this nuclear program. That's part of the reason why it was so strange that Trump didn't press more for inspections or an access to these sites, or even just the understanding of what the breadth of the North Korean nuclear program is. Remember, he got nothing from these negotiations other than this personal relationship with Kim Jong-un. I think that the Chinese probably have more, you know, specific contingency plans perhaps than even we do, given that this is right on their border. There could be massive flows of refugees into China from North Korea. And they probably have better contacts, obviously, in the North Korean military. So I do think there are probably, you know, plans on the shelf in both Washington and Beijing. I think the Chinese, frankly, if there's a complete state collapse, would be more positioned to do something given their kind of military alliance with North Korea, their history and proximity.
Man, that inventory point is a really good one, because an inventory of their nuclear arsenal was supposed to be like the first thing you got in a negotiation, and Trump didn't even achieve that. So I was thinking to myself, I wonder if they're sitting in the Pentagon with like 40 contingency plans for Navy SEALs to go to different parts of the country to like take those things by force and pray to God that they don't run into Beijing's version of the Navy SEAL. But maybe that's not even possible.
I mean, I'm sure, look, and this is not getting into anything sensitive, but I'm just sure that the U.S. Forces Korea, like our military command in South Korea with the South Koreans, has versions of contingency plans.
Yeah, for sure.
I do just think it's not like Iran, right, where we really know, you know, okay, they've got this one nuclear facility called Natanz. They've got this other nuclear facility called Gom. If hypothetically those were more advanced and they are not because the Iran nuclear deal set them back. But if they were and the regime kind of collapsed there, you'd be watching those two sites very carefully. In North Korea, I think it may be the infrastructure of their missile and nuclear program is likely more spread out and we don't know all of it. And that's what you'd look for in some collapse. And frankly, if there's a real kind of civil war or at least a elite kind of competition, are people trying to take control of nuclear weapons as a part of that competition? You know, so there are a lot of scenarios, and the worst ones, for the short term at least, are ones where these weapons are falling out of any kind of command and control.
Yeah, that is the horror scenario. It is notable, though, that, you know, they have dozens of nukes in North Korea, and Trump is just wishing them well and hoping for the best. And they continue to hammer away on Iran, who doesn't have nuclear weapons. So yeah. Let's talk about Iran for a bit. There's a couple of stories in the news worth getting into. So Iran last week put into orbit what it calls a military satellite. Arms control experts, you know, watch these quote unquote satellite launches carefully because many believe that they're just ways of testing intercontinental ballistic missile technology. And if you think about it, right, the goal in both cases, you shoot a payload of some sort into orbit, whether it's a satellite that then orbits the Earth or a warhead that comes back down on a target. It's very similar technology. Iran used a mobile missile launcher in this case, which is a significant technological advancement that caught people by surprise. This is by no means Iran's first attempt at a launch. Longtime Pod Save the World listeners probably remember the time last summer when Trump tweeted out a classified image of a photo of a failed space launch, like from his PDB, seemingly in an effort to brag about or take credit for its failure. So that was cool. Iran's missile program has concerned the U.S. for a very long time, and there have been many news reports over the years about ways, you know, that the U.S. or the Israelis or some international effort has tried to sabotage them with faulty parts and all these sorts of things. Mike Pompeo called the launch deeply troubling. He said the technology could be used in nuclear weapons delivery systems. The U.S. Space Force commander, General Raymond, called the satellite a, quote, tumbling webcam in space, unlikely providing intel, which I thought was pretty funny. So hours after the launch, Trump then tweeted that he instructed the U.S. Navy to shoot down, that's in quotes, and destroy any and all Iranian gunboats if they harass our ships at sea. So this is a response to another years-old problem of these little Iranian ships harassing U.S. naval vessels in the Persian Gulf. So if taken literally as an order, that tweet would significantly loosen the rules of engagement that normally determine when and how a Navy ship can take lethal action. He also seems to think that boats can fly, which is a bigger problem. But, you know, Ben, just like stepping back on both these, like how significant do you think this military satellite launch is? And if these are not new rules of engagement for Navy ships, like, can you describe to folks why the harassment from these ships or the flashpoint in this area is seen as such a area of tension?
Well, the good news is there might not be a war because Iran, to my knowledge, has not developed a flying ship. So there's nothing to shoot down there.
Thank God.
Look, they have a ballistic missile program. I mean, part of what this demonstrates is that sanctions are not stopping their ballistic missile program. I mean, there's this kind of wishful thinking that informs the entire Trump strategy of sanctions upon sanctions, that the sanctions will somehow bring them to their knees. And the reality is the Iranian government has always found money, no matter how many sanctions they're under, to make sure that they're still investing in their missile program and their nuclear program. And that's why, you know, you want a nuclear deal in place to roll back the nuclear program so that there's not a warhead that they can put on that missile. And you also, frankly, would have wanted to follow on the Iran nuclear deal with further negotiations about the missile program. And so what Emmanuel Macron, the French president, for instance, had been proposing around the time that Trump pulled out of the Iran deal, is you take the Iran deal as a foundation and then you negotiate another deal that addresses the ballistic missile program. And ultimately, that form of negotiation is the only way you're going to deal with this. And instead, we're in this endless cycle of provocation where everything Trump does invites an Iranian response. And so you get missile launches like this, you get resumption of nuclear activity and all the rest of it. What was also evident in that tweet is that it came after a Fox and Friends segment.
Come on, about, really?
Yeah, about this launch. And so, the internet sleuths did a pretty good job of reconstructing the timeline of Trump kind of acting on a recommendation from Fox that you attack the Iranian Navy. That John Bolton, by the way, has also been putting forward. I mean, look, the reality is that the Iranians have these kind of small ships that kind of harass. We've seen them harass tankers. We've seen them come too close to U.S. naval vessels at times. And there's this kind of fantasy on the far right in this country, you know, that basically we can just sink all these ships and send some message to Iran. Again, I think that, like everything else that's happened between the United States and Iran the last 2 years, like, were we to take that action and start sinking Iranian ships, you know, you'd inevitably see an Iranian escalation, and then we'd be right back where we were in January on the brink of a real war here. And so, put it this way, it makes no sense to respond to an Iranian ballistic missile test potentially by just sinking some ships and by the way, killing the Iranians, presumably, who are on those ships. It's just another sign that this is not a strategy of Trump's. This is just like a series of actions that make him somehow feel good and you know, meet his political test of showing how what a tough guy he is. But all the Iranian behavior is getting worse across the board, measured against what the U.S. objectives are.
Yeah. So another like pretty interesting Iran story I saw was, so according to the New York Times, Mike Pompeo is preparing a legal argument that says the U.S. is still part of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. And that might make you think, oh, great, they saw the error of their ways. They're going to return to sensible, constructive diplomacy instead of, you know, assassinating Qasem Soleimani or whatever. Sadly, no. Here apparently is the play Pompeo is trying to run. So there's an embargo on selling conventional arms to Iran that was part of the Iran deal. This ban on small arms is set to expire in October. So Pompeo apparently wants to put forward a UN Security Council resolution that would extend that conventional weapons ban indefinitely. So friend of the pod, Wendy Sherman, is in the New York Times piece quoted explaining why she doesn't think this will fly. She said at the time when they passed this provision, the Russians didn't want a conventional arms embargo to begin with. And, you know, they only agreed to one with some sunset provisions. So here's where this re-entering the Iran deal piece comes back in. So the strategy, I guess, is for the U.S. to put forward this resolution, you extend the arms embargo, and when the Russians veto it, the U.S. will say, well, we're still a party to the JCPOA, and we're going to invoke the so-called snapback provisions and put in place these broad-based U.N. sanctions on Iran that were there in place, thanks to Obama, before the Iran deal was passed and went into effect. And this is understandably, I think, confusing to the Iranians because they point out how vocal Trump and Pompeo have been that they have pulled out of the Iran deal. But Ben, I mean, you know this deal inside and out. How important is this arms embargo that they're fighting over? And like, how do you think allies in Europe or the Russians or the Chinese will respond to an effort to just put in place these broad-based sanctions from pre-2015?
Unfortunately, the listeners at home can't see me violating the face touching rule to just rub my temples in complete exasperation. Where to start? So first of all, we did insert, and frankly, it was kind of a coup of the negotiating team, this provision that if there was, if one of the members of the P5 plus one, the permanent five members of the UN Security Council who would negotiate the deal, kind of determined that Iran was in violation, that there could be a snapback, a reimposition of the UN sanctions on Iran. However, the United States formally withdrew from the JCPOA, gave formal notification to the parties of the Iran deal that they were leaving the JCPOA. And so the idea that we have any kind of credible leg to stand on to utilize the provisions of the JCPOA to make other countries reimpose multilateral sanctions is like completely laughable. It's complete and utter bullshit, and nobody's going to go along with it. You know, nobody's going to join us in suggesting that the U.S. can reimpose multilateral sanctions on its own when it's not even a party to the JCPOA. I think another point here is that this arms embargo, Leakey does not begin to describe it. Russia doesn't even acknowledge that it exists.
Really?
Like, it's not like Iran hasn't been able to purchase any conventional weapons because right. of this arms embargo. And, you know, the Chinas and Russia of the world find ways to have their relationships with the Iranian military, never mind, you know, the North Koreas of the world here. So, yeah, it's been a useful tool, I guess, in constraining the number of places that Iran could can purchase certain things, you know, once again, this is like the theology of the Iran opponents in the U.S. who are constantly just looking for some other sanction to throw at the Iranians as if that's going to make any difference. You know, I mean, think of the contradiction that's implicit in what Pompeo is doing, not just wanting to use the JCPOA when you've been out of it. What about the contradiction that we're constantly being told how scary Iran is, how powerful Iran is, how they're on the brink of, you know, taking over the whole Middle East and not, you know, the whole world. But this arms embargo is really working. You know, it's really squeezing them. They, you know, I mean, this is not the yeah. point here, guys, you know, and the things that Iran does that are troubling, its nuclear program, its missile program, it's done, you know, around any, you know, arms embargo anyway.
And so even if they were successful at snapping back these sanctions, then we'd have to enforce them. Are we going to enforce sanctions on like a French bank that does business with Iran or like a German company that buys oil? Because like that's the extent of these sanctions, right? It would be like broad-based energy sector stuff.
Yeah, and some of that's already kind of frozen. You know, it's a lot of the activity from the West, right, has already been frozen just because the U.S. is imposing sanctions. But if you were going to go around the world and start enforcing this, you know, it would also be how are you going to stop like a potential Russian shipment of arms? You
right.
know? Like how far are we willing to go to physically enforce this? And again, I think this is just Pompeo, you know, picking yet another fight about yet another aspect of Iran policy that the you know, hypothetically, if they extended this arms embargo, what would be materially different anyway from how things are now, you know, not yeah. much other than the U.S., you know, going around the world and having yet another thing that it can bother other countries with.
Yeah. Weird. Okay. Well, we'll keep watching that one.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Brazil. Cause there's some bad news there for Trump's, you know, one of his favorite authoritarian leaders, Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil. So the Brazilian Supreme Court has authorized an investigation into allegations of corruption and obstruction of justice by Bolsonaro. This comes after a guy named Sergio Moro, who is the former justice minister, accused Bolsonaro of attempting to interfere with police investigations to protect his supporters. Two of Bolsonaro's kids, his two sons, are under investigation for embezzlement. So this is pretty close to home for Bolsonaro. The Washington Post notes that if true, these allegations could form the basis of an impeachment trial. And a recent poll shows that 57% of Brazilians support impeachment. And unlike us, the Brazilians are big fans of impeaching presidents. Bolsonaro would be the third one removed from office since the 1980s if this happened. All of this is happening as Brazil deals with just a massive COVID outbreak. So, you know, look, I don't want to get my hopes up too high, Ben, that, you know, Bolsonaro will go down. But when I look around the world, I think Bolsonaro, if you total up like attacks on democracy, rule of law, exacerbating climate change, like he's got to be one of the top, what, 3, 5, 10 most dangerous leaders on the planet right now.
Bolsonaro, I mean, yeah, particularly in the sense of like his capacity to take what is a very big democracy and drag it into this authoritarian column while doing grave damage to the environment, right, with the destruction of the Amazon, which could be irreversible damage to climate change, not to mention, you know, kind of just the rights of the Brazilian people. I think what's been so telling to me about this and why it feels like it may very well threaten him is, first of all, he hasn't been hugely popular since he took office. There have been these corruption clouds around, particularly his sons. And this COVID-19 response has been an absolute disaster. You know, I mean, he makes, you know, he's definitely giving Trump a run for his money. What's interesting to me is that it seems like some of Brazil's political class is beginning to anticipate Bolsonaro's collapse, right? So this kind of latest spat really began when the justice minister in Brazil resigned because he got in a fight with Bolsonaro about essentially whether or not Bolsonaro could fire the national police chief, which is ostensibly supposed to be under the auspices of this justice minister. The reason I point this out is that this justice minister, he's a bit younger. He's, you know, probably foresees himself having some form of political future. He had been involved in the prosecution of Lula, the previous Brazilian president, who's a political opponent of Bolsonaro's. It feels like, unlike here in the U.S., where Republicans haven't begun to jump ship, some of these latest developments feel like people kind of realizing, I don't necessarily want to go down with the Bolsonaro ship, you know, and so I'm going to jump off. And that's why you get resignations like this. That's why you get, you know, investigations and calls for impeachment in a way that we haven't seen, certainly beyond outside of the Democratic Party here in the U.S. So it does feel to me like, you know, perhaps in part because of his completely incompetent COVID-19 response, Bolsonaro is on pretty shaky ground.
Yeah, let's hope. So I will look a little good news. So New Zealand announced that they have basically eliminated the coronavirus following an intensive period of social distancing. So that means that there is currently no widespread community spread happening, but obviously it'll take vigilance to keep it that way. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was quick to stress that this is, you know, the virus is like a burning ember of a fire. It could reignite if they're not careful. But New Zealand is moving to a less strict version of their lockdown. It'll allow for more travel. It'll allow more businesses to open up, maybe schools open up. New Zealand had 1,122 cases and 19 COVID deaths. So, you know, good news story here, Ben. It must be nice to live on a literal island where you can, you know, lock the place down pretty easily with a smaller population. But this is also, I think, an example of great political leadership and doing the right thing quickly.
Yeah. And I want to say I'm glad we had this opportunity because I need to apologize to all my Kiwi friends, the people of New Zealand. It's been pointed out to me on various platforms that for some reason I continually say Jacinda Ardern, which I have no idea why I do that. But I'm using this opportunity to say I do know it's Jacinda Ardern. I have certain pronunciation tics that worldos have...
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, worldos have held me accountable for them. So I want you to know I am accountable and I'm sorry for that. In part because... she's just such an astonishingly positive example for progressive leadership that it can be nationally unifying, extremely competent, values-based, and deliver results. Granted, it's an island. They have a manageable challenge in terms of the scale of their population and their geographic distance. But nevertheless, she's taken every step right. The deployment of testing, the public messaging that she did, the modeling of behavior, the... you know, application of social distancing. I think it is going to be, we've said this before, but it cannot be stressed enough. We need to be learning from other countries that are handling this better than we are. And we now have multiple examples, some of which are democracies, some of which are not. So it's not like it's all restricted to one political system. And here, I think what we see is a nation that marshaled all of the different strategies. Again, the deployment of healthcare equipment, of testing, of social distancing, of kind of responsible, clear communication from leadership that then is enabling the incremental reopening of the economy. You know, that's clearly the model that is going to get us off of Zoom and back into life. Unfortunately, what it feels like in the U.S. is some individual states are learning from New Zealand, but not all 50 and certainly not the federal government.
Yeah, that's right. That's totally right. Some more good news that might allow us to get back to a non-Zoom life. So a group of scientists at Oxford University were able to build on this previous round of clinical trials that they'd already completed and are going to test a potential coronavirus vaccine on more than 6,000 people by the end of next month. The formula that they created, I guess, worked well on monkeys in a trial done in Montana. So this is exciting. They obviously need to prove that it's safe, that it's effective in humans, and then long-term produce like literally billions of this vaccine. But it is great news that this big UK study is underway because it can inform all the other research that happens and R&D, et cetera. Also last week, you pointed this one out to me, Ben, world leaders pledged to accelerate work on COVID testing and drugs and vaccines and then share them. So this effort includes the French, the Germans, Spain, South Africa, a bunch of countries. The U.S., infuriatingly, did not participate in this WHO effort because I guess, you know, Trump would rather blame the World Health Organization than, like, you know, get in the game and address the problem. So the effort generally is rightly focused on the need to figure out, you know, equitable distribution of treatments and vaccines. So you don't have a situation like we did with the HIV/AIDS, where it was like completely survivable in the United States, but wiping out people across Africa. You know, Ben, this brought me back to the conversation we had with Sam Power a couple weeks ago, that like institutions, organizations like the UN, the World Health Organization, the G7, the G20, they are only as effective as member states make them. And our president just seems determined to gut them for political reasons, even if improving them would save lives or prevent a future pandemic. And like, it drives me crazy.
Yeah, no, I mean, normally the US would be right in the middle of this kind of effort, because, you know, again, all the World Health Organization is the sum of its parts, right? And we have been traditionally the biggest part of the World Health Organization. And you know, what all these efforts point to, right, is that there's kind of a, you know, just like the virus is the great equalizer, recognizes no borders, the search for treatments and certainly for a vaccine will be more effective if it's coordinated across borders and if the best scientists of every country are pooling research and lessons learned and trying to figure out ways to surge this type of capacity. Because there's also two steps to this, Tommy, right? Like the first is we'd love to get to a vaccine. And again, you'd want the best minds in the world to be collaborating on that. But then also, how is that vaccine going to be scaled up and distributed around the world? You know, if it's developed in one country, does that mean that it only starts in that country? How do you ensure that there's adequate scale? How are people going to feel in some countries if, you know, everybody else is getting vaccinated in a certain part of the world and they're not? I mean,
especially if like all the vaccines are being produced in India and China and those people can't afford to purchase them or aren't given them by their government. That's a deeply fucked up situation, you could see.
Yeah, these are scenarios that require very careful international collaboration and coordination and some sense of protocols that are developed. And again, like in the absence of the US, it's interesting to see how the international community functions. It's kind of the European countries and like a South Korea and Japan, you know, talking intermittently to China and India and the US just sitting on the sidelines. It's very strange to see. Hopefully, you know, our election is going to be kind of in mid-stride here, and you know, hopefully the U.S. is able to rejoin those efforts after the election, because we've also already seen the problem of not being a party to these efforts. So, for instance, the WHO had over 1 million tests available in February, and you know, the Trump administration made the decision not to take those testing kits and develop our own, and that contributed to the testing failures in this country, right? So we're not winning by being outside of the international processes. Like we're losing on every to use Trump's language, we're losing on every metric of cases, of deaths, of lack of testing. And it's a shame we're not a part of this, but I hope that this all goes well. And ultimately that'd be in our interest too.
Yeah, absolutely would. Good for all of them for stepping up and doing this. It's, you know, it's very important. It's also like, it's nice to see leaders like Merkel and Macron and others like stepping up and pushing the agenda when we're absent.
Yeah, it's just like, it's mildly kind of reassuring that they're out there, you know, doing things and that Jacinda Ardern is out there like doing things and, you know, and we're getting there state by state, right? But not collectively.
Pod Save the World is brought to you by the UN Refugee Agency. The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations, and they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR
by visiting unrefugees.org/donation. That's unrefugees.org/donation.
Let's talk Afghanistan for a minute. So, saw a report this week by NBC News that Trump complains almost daily to his team about the fact that U.S. service members are still deployed in Afghanistan and that they're now vulnerable to catching the coronavirus. You know, aides say he's also angry about the lack of progress in peace talks with the Taliban. So both very legitimate things to be angry about. Some stats. So as of Monday, the Afghan Ministry of Public Health reported about 1,700 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and 57 deaths. But from other reporting I saw, I think like that's probably charitably talking about 10,000 people getting tested in a country of 35 million. So I put no stock in those numbers. And given how weak Afghanistan's public health system is in like basic lack of sanitation, I think a massive outbreak is probably not a question of if, but when. They also share a very porous border with Iran. So you're seeing big flows of Afghans who had found work in Iran now coming back home to Afghanistan because the economy has been decimated by COVID. So they're probably bringing it with them. So anyway, Trump is right to be concerned about a potential outbreak. But this withdrawal desire does seem to be driven by his longstanding and, again, understandable desire to get out of Afghanistan. So by comparison, you know, we have troops in Italy, we have troops in Japan, South Korea. You're not seeing the same withdrawal discussion. But we are currently pulling troops out of Afghanistan. So the Pentagon says we'll be down to 8,600 troops in Afghanistan by July. Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan, who's been in charge of the diplomacy, is still trying to get the Afghans and the Taliban to talk, to move forward on prisoner exchanges and other like sticking points in these negotiations. But it's going very poorly. The Taliban have rejected calls for a ceasefire because of the coronavirus. They rejected a request that there would be a ceasefire for Ramadan. Instead, they're like increasing attacks on government forces. So, Ben, this was my thought experiment for you. Like, you're Ashraf Ghani. You're the president of Afghanistan. You know your position is politically tenuous because there were these months of instability after a disputed election. The pandemic is ravaging your country. It's literally infected dozens of your own staff members in your own, you know, palace. The Taliban is targeting you. Your benefactor, the Americans, have repeatedly signaled that they just want out as fast as possible. Mike Pompeo just flew over to yell at you and said he'd cut aid. Like, what's your next move? Do you just move to cut a bad deal with the Taliban? Do you flee to Europe and live in Paris the rest of your life? Do you, you know, panic dial the Russians, the Chinese? Like, well, this is, seems like an existential threat. Like, what do you think he might do here?
Yeah, like talk about like the worst job in the world. Like, I don't know why anyone would want to be president of Afghanistan.
Brutal.
And, you know, Ashraf Ghani doesn't come across as like this big power broker. You know, I've been in a lot of meetings with him. He's kind of a technocratic, soft-spoken guy coming out of the international development world. I mean, I think, first of all, you know, we should be concerned about our troops. We should be concerned about the Afghan people, who Trump is clearly not, you know, particularly concerned about, given that lack of infrastructure. There's an absurdity to all this. I mean, you mentioned that we'll be down to 8,600 troops in July. For all the rhetoric from Trump about ending these wars and stuff, that's about the number of troops that were in Afghanistan when Obama left office.
Yeah.
You know, and Trump just surged them, a surge he clearly, you know, I'm not even sure why he did it at the time. And now we're just getting it back down there. And here's what I take away from this, Tommy, is that it's notable that when Trump feels like he's made a decision, he even on something as complex as withdrawing troops from someplace, he kind of just expects it to happen right away, and doesn't see the picture that it fits into. And this is what happened in Syria, where, you know, we all talked about, like, we could agree with the idea that you want to draw down these forces, but the way he did it was he just kind of made an announcement and expected them out like the next day, and then literally that's what happened. They get yanked out, and there's terrible consequences, and then we kind of send them back into a different part of Syria to guard an oil field. I mean, this reminds me of that, where it's like he thought, okay, there's a deal with the Taliban, it's done, get the troops out. But of course, the details matter, and the Taliban's not following through on its own commitments, and this isn't really leading to any peace. And it's like all these deals, like with Kim Jong-un, like he meets him, problems over, well, Kim Jong-un just keeps building nuclear weapons and building missiles. That's what the Taliban did. They made a deal. They're kind of basically ignoring it. They're pocketing all the kind of good feeling around it from Trump. and waiting for us to withdraw. And there's Khalilzad out there trying to salvage something from this and keep this, you know, somehow together. So again, what needs to happen is this kind of careful diplomacy that continues to ensure that, like, this withdrawal is both orderly but is accompanied by the political steps that were supposed to happen separately. Because if I'm Ashraf Ghani, yeah, what I start to be doing is looking to China, looking to Russia. If I can't get a backstop from the United States, I'll get a backstop elsewhere. And, you know, it becomes, you know, a very different kind of negotiation and reality for him. But I think that's where this may very well head.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been sort of long time interest from the Chinese and others in, like, yeah, rare earth minerals and things they have there. So there's a lot of reasons countries would want to exploit the country in ways that are very sad for their future.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The Afghan people, like, for the last 40 years, are the ones who end up getting screwed.
Yeah, of course. Two more quick things before we get to your interview. So we've talked previously about all the ways that Trump was warned about the coronavirus, even when he was talking it down publicly. One of those was through classified briefings, including the president's daily briefing, or PDB, which is, you know, the most important intelligence product in the U.S. government that gets briefed to him every morning, or should be. So The Washington Post did some additional reporting on this subject and found it's much more extensive than we knew before. U.S. intelligence agencies warned about the coronavirus in more than a dozen classified briefings prepared for Trump in January and February, so early on. The Post wrote that for weeks, the PDB traced the virus spread around the globe, made clear that China was suppressing information about the contagion's transmissibility and lethal toll, and raised the prospect of dire political and economic consequences. That was a quote. So everything you needed to know was in these PDB pieces. They also note in the Washington Post report that Trump routinely skips reading his PDB. He's only briefed on it orally two or three times a week because he just seems to think it's a waste of his time. So Ben, you know, like, we knew Trump had received warnings. I guess we just didn't know how often and how comprehensive it was. This report really makes clear that this was not in any way an intelligence failure. This was the Trump administration, Trump himself, actively ignoring clear warnings. I mean, these briefings go to him. They also go to the National Security Staff. They go to cabinet secretaries where relevant. And the briefings we're talking about were January, February, right? February 26th was the day he said, within a couple of days, we'll be close to zero cases, and the day after, you know, and then we'll be down to none. So anyway, like, this is well-trodden territory. But, like, when you see the volume of it, it just reminds me how scandalous it is. I mean, it's just, it's a dereliction of duty that directly led to people being killed. It is like a 9/11 style failing. It should be investigated by the Intel Committee, potentially a 9/11 style commission. I mean, it's just, it is unbelievable.
Yeah. I got the PDB every morning for over 7 years. Because as you say, it goes to, you know, several dozen people actually get the written PDB. And I'll come back to that in a second. And then, like, a small group of us, I don't know, like five of us, would sit down with Obama and literally his first meeting of the day. So people understand, and this isn't because Obama was so great. This is just how any normal president, I think, would normally do things.
Bush too, yeah.
Yeah, Obama would get a written version of the PDB in his residence in the morning. So first thing he's reading in the morning is his PDB. The first thing I read every single day when I got to work was his PDB. Then we all meet together. And it really does shape your day. It's, you know, this, if there's a crisis and you're being briefed on it every morning, that leads to all the other meetings that take place, right? So, you know, if we sat down and I remember the Ebola case very clearly, I learned about Ebola in the PDB, you know, so suddenly it's like, there's X many cases in Africa, we're watching this Ebola outbreak, and it's suddenly now it's one more thing that's on the list of things that you're kind of thinking about and talking about. And then when it doesn't go away, when you see, you know, a repeated briefing that this is getting worse, then Obama says to Susan Rice, you know, stand up a process. And suddenly there's an interagency set of meetings happening with the Pentagon, the State Department, but also the CDC and the NIH. And that's how the Ebola response started to crank up. And, you know, it all starts in the PDB, and then it flows to what is the government going to do about this warning it's getting from the intelligence community. And Trump, you know, because he has it, you know, we treat it almost like a reality show when he attacks the intelligence community and says they're wrong about Russia and it's a hoax and they're the deep state and he doesn't need briefings, and we kind of chuckle at the reports that he likes pictures and
can be, right.
But now we see why that matters, you know, because apparently, if he was acting in just even taking the minimal actions that you would take, I mean, at an absolute minimum, Tommy, even if he did nothing with this information, he at least should not have been lying to us, right? Because what we know, and I think what any investigation has to stack up, is what was Trump being told, and then what was he saying publicly the same day? You know, he was literally acting like this was going to go away, cases were going to go down to zero, calm the stock market, the Chinese are handling this right, at a time when we now know he was reading or being briefed the opposite. It's mind-boggling. And to your point about how the scandal doesn't even begin to describe it, it's not only that he didn't take any responsible preventive measures to deploy tests to get ready, but he was actually saying the opposite of what he was being told by the people who knew what was actually happening, you know? And that, you know, I think when the history of this is written, January and February of 2020 are the months that are going to be the most maddening, because that was the time when he had warning, which is what the PDB is, warning, and not only did nothing, but did the opposite of what he should have done.
Yeah, completely squandered it. It is so frustrating. Someone flagged for me a conversation I did for this show with Susan Rice in 2017. And we spent about 5 minutes talking about Ebola and the next pandemic. And it was clear how searing that experience had been for her. And it, like, we're going to clip and somehow share this, the piece of this interview, because it is precedent. She talks about how, like, what do you do if this, if a flu-like virus emerges? Do you shake hands? She's talking about how every expert says it's inevitable. And, like, obviously, all of that information translated into the pandemic plan that was left for the Trump team, the pandemic coordinator position that was created at the NSC. It's just like the number, it's like every problem with Trump, the number of blinking lights that were ignored, it just stacks up so high that it almost distracts you from how unbelievable any single one of them was, if that makes sense.
And you know what bothers me, Tommy, is you made you alluded to this. A lot of people get the PDB, right? You know, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the White House Chief of Staff, the National Security Advisor. I got it as Deputy National Security Advisor. You know, again, it probably runs into the dozens because it's usually kind of cabinet level, deputy cabinet level.
And we all know, like, Jared got it.
Yeah.
Like, right, all those people wanted it and they didn't give a shit about protecting intelligence. They all got it.
And so the point is that these people knew this too. You know, like these people who work for Trump, Pence was getting it. So like it's not just Donald Trump. This is not like a briefing to one person. They were all lying to us, or at least in their silence, they were lying. Like the ethical and moral failure of any official in this government who was getting those briefings and being silent about them, or calling it a hoax, or parroting whatever Trump's talking point of the day is, or going out like the White House did repeatedly as late as I think March and saying that this virus was contained.
Yep.
Again, like it's the normal language of scandal doesn't apply because it's not like one mistake. It's the character of this entire White House, you know, coming to bear on the biggest public health emergency in a century.
Yeah, it's a refusal to do any work, listen to any experts, and then a willingness of all of these monsters to cover up for whatever he says for political purposes and deny facts and, you know, mislead the nation. It's a scandal. Okay, last thing, which is some good news, goodish news. We talked about the story of Captain Crozier and the U.S. Theodore Roosevelt a couple times. So Crozier was the Navy captain who sent that desperate letter about a COVID outbreak on the aircraft carrier he commanded. He got relieved of his command. He caught COVID. He's been quarantined ever since. And then the acting Secretary of the Navy, Thomas Modly, handled the situation so badly. He flew to the ship in Guam. He insulted Crozier over the loudspeaker to his own men and women he was commanding. Modly then resigned because he just screwed it up. So the latest on this saga is that the Navy leadership has recommended that Captain Crozier get his old job back. And I guess this decision is sitting with Mark Esper, who's the Secretary of Defense, who's reviewing it. I think the reason why is that General Milley, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, wants to do a full-blown review of the incident first. And I think that's part of the original sin of Crozier being relieved. They didn't do this review. They just like they got rid of him because they thought that's what Trump wanted. And I bet Milley is thinking like, it was a mistake to fire Crozier before a review the first time. Let's just do one this time. So hopefully this is trending the right way. But, you know, like it does seem like they clearly know they need to right this wrong. The Navy does, because almost a fifth of the Theodore Roosevelt's crew caught COVID-19. The bad news, Ben, is according to CNN, that there's another ship with nearly 50 sailors who are sick. It's the USS Kidd. It's a Navy destroyer. They've tested less than half of the ship's roughly 330 sailors, and a huge percentage of them have it. So again, just like, this is not a problem with one ship that was in Guam or the Navy specifically. It does seem like it's a crisis that could sweep through the entire armed forces. And I don't think we're hearing a lot of discussion about mitigating it, about like preserving force readiness, about all the things you would think would be top of mind right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the good news here, as you alluded to, is like it's always heartening to see some institution take corrective action, you know, at a time when institutions have been failing left and right, like to see an injustice kind of at least appears like it's going to be remedied. And frankly, you know, if they want to run a process, that's like what an institution should do. I do think at points, you know, what Crozier said that was so powerful, right, is that if the U.S. was like in a war or something, like they'd stay on the ship and risk having COVID. But we're not, you know. And what that acting Navy secretary said that was so offensive in part was like, they should act like they're at a war because China's out there and they're bad. No, like, we're not in a war. And frankly, you know, that these ships certainly have to be deployed to. And in this context, I think the safety and health of Americans in uniform needs to come first and foremost ahead of whatever, you know, mission that might be compromised by doing that. Because it's not worth losing an American service member for some mission that is not absolutely essential here. And so I think the principle that I would hope is applied is that that the health and safety of Americans is paramount here.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, we'll take a quick break. And then when we come back, we'll have Ben's conversation with Rana Ayub about how COVID's affecting India and Prime Minister Modi generally.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic Raised Bed and Garden Soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
I'm very pleased now to be joined by one of the leading, really, journalist voices in the world and a Washington Post global opinions writer, Rana Ayub. Rana, thanks so much for joining us from Mumbai, and Ramadan Mubarak to you. How are things doing there?
Hi, Ben. I mean, great to be joining this. Ramadan Mubarak to you and all to all the viewers. As I talk, I mean, we haven't slept in the last two nights. We have been doing, me and two other volunteers, besides the reporting that I'm doing, we're also doing relief work from across the city, and specifically in Dharavi, which is Asia's largest slum with a population of 1.25 million. And it is estimated that about 25% of that population, which is the poorest of the poor, could be infected. And, you know, in places like this, where people live in clusters and these slums, that you cannot really ask them about social distancing. That concept really doesn't work. So the virus is spreading rapidly in India. We have 30,000 positive cases. But what's really distressing is not the virus as much as the starvation and the hunger and the poverty that the migrants and the workers and the laborers in India fear could kill them before the virus does. So me and two other volunteers, we decided to take the things in our own hands, you know, trying to help a few pockets here and there. We raised a funding drive on Keto, which is this platform. And, you know, we are raising money every day. We are going to collecting, buying the daily essentials and supplying it to families. Between the last 3 days, we have helped about 3,000 families, but that's what we're doing. I mean, besides the journalism that we're all doing, I think we're all multitasking. So we're all exhausted.
We talked about this on the show a bit when the lockdown was ordered by Modi. I was wondering, in a country with such population density and such extreme poverty in places, did the government take any precautions, or work done to mitigate the fact that it's basically impossible for people who don't have access to food and water and live in very close proximity to each other to follow these guidelines? I mean, what is the government doing to deal with the that risk of poverty and hunger?
I mean, the Prime Minister gave a speech on live television, and he gave Indians just about 4 hours before he announced the lockdown. Now, in a country of 1.3 billion, out of which 60% of the country lives below the poverty line, not everybody has their refrigerators stocked. Here there are people who are daily wage earners who have just enough to eat three meals in a day. And here, the Prime Minister gives about 2 or 3 days notice for the country to cheer, come on their balconies and cheer the efforts made by the government, but just gives about 4 hours for people in the country to prepare. So I don't think the Prime Minister and the government led by Mr. Modi was prepared to handle this crisis. What we saw on television was, you know, this everyday, the Prime Minister trying to distract, saying you get on your balconies and you bang your utensils and you light your candles. But you have to understand that most people in India, especially the poorest lot, do not even have balconies to stand on. So you are still addressing the upper middle class and the middle class. You are not addressing the poor of this country who do not even have a television set. So the moment this lockdown was announced, I remember within 5 minutes, I stepped out of the house and there was total chaos on the streets. Everybody was, there was chaos buying and everybody was in a frenzy and there was nothing like social distancing. And the poor were just staring and the poor just did not even have enough money to buy the meal for the next day. The PM CARES, which is basically the Prime Minister's, initiative to raise funds for the poor. There's a news story that came yesterday that the fund will not be audited. Now, that's more like what, it's a very Trumpian thing that, how can the Prime Minister collect funds and to the tune of billions of rupees and not have any accountability for that money when millions of people in this country are going hungry? We have visuals of thousands and thousands of laborers across the country walking to their hometowns in the scorching sun, walking for 24 to 48 hours a day without food. So I think the country was extremely ill prepared for this. And even now, while we are in lockdown, a lot of work is being done by the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, the activists, the human rights workers. These are the ones that you see on the streets as opposed to the government officials. For instance, I was in Dharavi today. And, the slum, which I said has a population of 1.25 million, it has not been cleaned for the last 1 week. There has not been a single sanitation worker because they believe that if they go and clean the area, they will test positive. Now, that happens because that area has the poorest of the poor population and they have just been let to die. And there are migrant workers who tell me that they don't have food. And the moment they step out to beg or borrow or ask for money, the police beats them and they're asked to leave. So at this point of time, they have an uncertain future.
And do you have any sense of, is there any accurate reporting or data about how widespread the disease is itself? Or does that data just not exist right now?
Well, that data really doesn't exist right now because India is not really testing as much. We are testing about 250 individuals per million. And that's very little. So when the Prime Minister of the country says that we do not have as many cases as we expected, it's because we are not testing as many people. For instance, 2 weeks ago, Mumbai, the financial capital of this country, had 50 corona positive journalists. And these are people who are just reporting on the streets. And these are people who have access and privilege. So if these people, if 50 journalists test positive, you can imagine the number of people in this country who are susceptible to the virus, who could actually be asymptomatic and could actually be COVID positive. So, and we're still talking about urban India. We still do not have figures for rural India, which is a big part of India. We still do not know what are the measures, what are the testing samples in those areas, how many individuals are being tested in villages. Because I think the priority for the country at this point of time is that, the villages do not need testing, the villages need food. So at this point of time, there's no data specifically to say that you know, this is the percentage of Indians who could possibly, you know, be positive in the next couple of weeks or months. But so right now, India stands at 30,000 cases. But when I spoke to health workers and when I spoke to officials in the government in off the record conversations, they said that the figures could go. You could easily multiply it 5 times, and that's the figure that we have for India. And India has not peaked yet, and the maximum number of cases will only be sometime in June and July.
And when you go out to deliver food and support and supplies and things, what do you see? Do you see people abiding by social distancing measures? Is that impossible in the slums? Or are you seeing people who are affected by the illness? What are your impressions?
So there are two Indias, Ben. One elite India, upper middle class India, where social distancing is observed. And one is the underprivileged India, where social distancing is a luxury, which they cannot afford, which is being imposed on them against their will, because they know they are being beaten if this... But some spaces we still go out, especially when we go out in Dharavi, there's nothing like social distancing. I mean, there is a small little, there's one room and there are 8 people in the house and there is one bathroom for 100 families. How do you maintain social distancing when there is no sanitation facilities, when there is no soap, when there is no, you know, water 24 hours a day? How do you expect the basic levels of sanitation to be maintained? How do you expect social distancing in these spaces? So I think even it's kind of obscene, actually, when I talk to them about social distancing, because these people are talking about hunger, and then you tell them, you know what, can you practice social distancing in this cluster? Because they're just people crammed. Every house has the slums have common walls, and they're literally living into each other's houses. So, and they're crammed, they're living in clusters. So social distancing is only being practiced in the elite upper middle class in India, which is mostly the urban cities.
And so you've obviously reported a lot on Prime Minister Modi and his recent steps, and we've talked about this a bit on the show. You mentioned the fund he set up that has no oversight. Are there other steps that the government is taking that concern you that could be additional powers that he is assuming in a crisis that he might not give up? Do you worry about that?
What Mr. Modi is doing is no different from what Viktor Orban is doing, or what Netanyahu is doing, or what other world leaders are doing in a crisis, is that he's using draconian measures to silence voices of dissent and criticism that have been very vocal in the last couple of months, especially with the Islamophobia, the virus of Islamophobia, which is much more rampant than the coronavirus in the country. So in the last 3 weeks itself, India's finest journalists have been slapped with draconian terror charges with the Unlawful Activity Prevention Act for reporting the truth in Kashmir. And this is just last week, two of India's brightest journalists. One of India's leading editors, Siddharth Vardarajan, who runs an independent website called The Wire, has been issued, there is a case against him for allegedly reporting fake news, which is actually genuine news, by the Indian state. Another columnist, Ram Guha, had his column removed from a leading newspaper, Hindustan Times, because that column was critical, that editorial was critical of Modi government's measures, the relief measures that he has taken to mitigate this. So Mr. Modi is using every possible draconian measure to silence voices of dissent and to distract the attention of people from the immediate concern, and the immediate concern being poverty and hunger. So what he's doing right now is, even at this point of time, the kind of Islamophobia that we have seen. I remember when the virus spread in the first 2 weeks, Mr. Modi's Union Minister for Minority Affairs called Muslims... said that Muslims were Talibanizing the coronavirus. And for the Union Minority Affairs Minister to say this, that had the effect the government wanted to. There was it is a given now in India. The narrative in India right now is that Muslims are spreading the virus, and wherever there are maximum positive cases it is because of Muslims. And this is not a conversation in the lower middle class or the uneducated sectors. I'm talking about this conversation is happening about in regular Indian households and upper middle class households on WhatsApp conversations. The narrative is that Muslims are behind spreading this virus in the country. And when you have the ministers in the ruling government, when you have cops giving these statements, and when Muslims are being apprehended and arrested for allegedly spitting on people to spread the virus, and you have dozens of fake videos doing the round of Muslims misbehaving, and our television news channels, which basically are towing the line of the Indian government, are an extended propaganda arm of Mr. Modi. So you switch on Indian television news channels, and it's nauseating to see one of India's leading news channels, India Today, had a graphic of the virus with a Muslim skull cap, and that graphic went viral. And there are Muslim and there are news channels which are running headlines that about the Muslim virus, from the China virus to the Islamic virus in India. And so, and the Prime Minister, who's very, very vocal on Twitter, he's very vocal in the various videos that he uses to spread his messages, has not once lashed out at these people, or has not once admonished his own ministers and people who he follows on social media to stop making these comments, or you know, advised or has given a warning to these news channels. So I think I've never seen a more serious case of Islamophobia in India as I see it right now. And I remember just in the first week of virus, I posted something on Twitter. I said, what can a virus kill in a morally corrupt nation? And Indian liberals hauled me over the coals for saying that. And I said, unfortunately, that's the truth, because in a country where people are being killed, ministers in the government are giving hate speeches, which leads to a carnage, and the innocent are arrested, the virus, we have already killed a population. We have it's a morally corrupt society, when even through a pandemic we are identifying people by their clothes and by their religion. So and that's state enabled. It's a state enabled propaganda.
Yeah. So basically it's just all the trends that were already taking hold in India have just become more pronounced in the pandemic, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Well, what makes you, I mean, you're also out there, you know, doing your kind of private relief efforts. I mean, we've even followed people protesting some of the steps that the government's taken recently. I mean, is there a civil society or a sense of solidarity that gives you some hope amidst what is a very difficult situation?
So just before the country announced lockdown, you'd know that there were protests happening in the country against the citizenship bill that directly affects the 200 million Muslim minorities in the country. And there were nationwide protests happening. And Mr. Modi has silenced all voices of dissent. Of course, there are dissenting voices, and there were people protesting, and there were people protesting in millions just before the lockdown. But this pandemic has come in handy for Mr. Modi to silence all voices of dissent. Anand Teltumbre, who is one of India's leading intellectuals and civil rights activists, was arrested amidst the pandemic. And he's the man who's one of India's leading civil rights activists, Dalit rights activist, who's been working for free speech, who's been working against the Citizenship Amendment Bill. Some of India's finest academics have been behind bars in the last 6 months on the charges that they were conspiring to kill the Prime Minister of the country, for which they have absolutely no proof. So what does give me hope are the common people of this country, the students of this country who came in big numbers, a lot of the Muslim population for the first time. I mean, there have been majoritarian decisions taken by Mr. Modi in the last 6 years, but never before has the Indian Muslim really stepped out of the house to protest against Mr. Modi's draconian anti-Muslim agenda as it had in the last couple of months. So I think we do have voices of dissent, but Mr. Modi is trying to make sure that the voices are diluted with this propaganda that he has spread in the country, that these voices are actually anti-nationals. They are people like us, journalists like me who write for the Washington Post, are writing for the Washington Post because we are trying to delegitimize India's position internationally. You know, when a Time magazine does a cover on Modi, or when The Economist runs a cover on Modi, the journalists become anti-nationals who are basically CIA agents who are out there to delegitimize and, you know, give Mr. Modi a bad name. So the number of charges and defamation cases against journalists in India in the last 6 years, I think it's just phenomenal. The number of, I mean, more at this point of time, we don't really have voices of dissent in India. We have few of them, but most of them are behind bars. Most of our lawyers, one of our finest lawyers, are behind bars right now, and they are languishing in jail for the last 3 or 4 years. So I don't know. My hope is the people of this country. My hope are the people who have been donating to our charity drive, which we have been doing in the last 4 days. And it's so heartening to see, you know, when I started this drive 4 days ago on Keto, which is this platform, I really did not think that, you know, Indians will actually come forward to help the poor. But it reveals that there is hope for the country. You know, the kind of support that we have received for the relief campaign and the relief work that we have been doing shows that there is hope for the country. But it's not from the leadership. It's from within the people. It's from the dissenting voices, from people who disagree with the government. So there is hope. I mean, I'm an optimist. So I think we live in hope. I live in hope.
Well, thanks for giving us this picture. And if our listeners wanted to support any of your relief efforts, is there a way that they can do that?
Sure, they can write. I mean, we have, you know, the Keto website, and the Keto is this platform where we are raising funds, is on my Twitter. They can also write to me on rana.ayub@gmail.com, where we are, you know, collaborating and perhaps helping people as much as possible, because that is the need of the hour right now, to help the poor of this country, because we fear that the virus will not kill them. It's the starvation and the hunger that will kill the people of this country. So it's extremely important that we get all the help possible.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Rana. It's terrific to talk to you, and really wish you the best of luck in these circumstances.
Thank you so much, Ben. Great talking to you.
Thanks again to everybody for listening this week. Thanks to Rana Ayub. Ben, thanks to you. How you doing on the haircut front, by the way? I feel like I look like Colin Firth preparing to play a prisoner of war in a movie. I'm just a ragged piece of shit.
So I did, you know, as someone with very little hair, it actually is more important to cut your hair more frequently, or else you start to look very weird because, like, clumps come in the wrong place. So I actually ordered these clippers that I'd never used before, right?
Oh, no.
And the first time I tried to use them, they just basically started to pull not just the hair, but like my scalp off my head, like the most painful, like whatever setting was off. So my wife, who's much more handy than I am, I have the curse of, you know, knowing nothing about how to fix anything. She fixes this. And I have to say, I did buzz my head by myself for the first time and didn't, you know, come out looking too crazy here. So I may be having a silver lining, for always looking for hope. I may come out of this not having to pay for haircuts anymore if I can figure out how to just buzz my own head, which is not rocket science, but it's something that coronavirus has forced me to do.
No, that's a good one. It's a good time saver. Favreau used to just like straight up buzz his head. And one morning before coming to work, he realized he had missed a spot. So we like ran back in to like quickly fix it. And he didn't realize that he had left the setting on 0 and not like a 4 or whatever he normally used, and just like hammered a giant bald patch into the back of his head. And then had to come into the Senate office in like 2006 or whatever. And Obama just let him know that he was not looking good.
As like a, you know, segment of the population that like has lost hair throughout my 20s and 30s, I remember when Favreau used to shave his head, and I always found it like offensive, an offensive luxury that people with good hair shave their heads. You know, it's like, don't take it for granted, man.
Words to live by. Don't take anything for granted.
Yeah, don't take anything for granted. We're learning that.
Take stock of what you have in this world right now, because you could be in prison in your house the next week and never know.
Yes.
Anyway, good show today. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk soon.
Pod Save the World is a product of Crooked Media. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our assistant producer is Jordan Waller. It's mixed and edited by Chris Basil. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Special thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim, who film and share our episodes as videos every week.
Hey, Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy. And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.